ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. This week, Ticklish Business talks Christmas as I sit down with Elwood Jones to discuss the 1944 Christmas classic, Meet Me in St. Louis.
Meet me in St. Louis, Louis, meet me at the fair. Don't tell me the lights are shining.
In the beginning of the film, Margaret O'Brien's Tootie Smith calls herself lucky to be born in her favorite city. Well, I'm lucky today to be talking about one of my favorite movies. Meet Me in St. Louis is a 1944 MGM musical that details a year in the life of the Smith family, who live in, you guessed it, St. Louis, before the 1904 World's Fair. Second eldest sister Esther, played by Judy Garland, must navigate the world of first love and family devotion when it's revealed that the Smiths are set to move to New York. Told through a series of chapters that mark the various seasons, we watch the Smiths fight, love, and ultimately realize that nothing is more important than family. The film was adapted from a series of short stories that Sally Benson wrote for New Yorker magazine in the early 1940s. The movie adaptation kickstarted a spate of successful Metro movie musicals filmed in Technicolor under the watchful eye of producer Arthur Freed.
With my high starch collar and my high top shoes and my hair piled high up on my head, I went to lose a jolly hour on the trolley and lost my heart instead. With his light brown derby and his bright green tie, he was quite the handsomest of men. I started to yen, so I counted to ten, then I counted to ten again. Clang, clang, clang went the trolley. Ding, ding, ding went the bell. Zing, zing, zing went my heartstrings. From the moment I saw him, I fell.
The film was directed by Vincent Minnelli, his third film after working on black and white features in 1943's Cabin in the Sky, which was the first film to boast an all-black cast, and 1934's I Dude It. The film's piggy bank, of sorts, was 23-year-old Judy Garland, who had rocketed into superstardom after playing Dorothy in 1939's The Wizard of Oz. In the 5 years since making Oz, Garland starred in 11 features. Meet Me in St. Louis was a game-changer for her, both personally and professionally. After playing children up until this time, Esther Smith helped Garland transition from child roles into adult roles. And unlike her past films opposite Mickey Rooney, Meet Me in St. Louis doesn't subscribe to the typical musical premise of let's put on a show. The film also introduced her to her second husband, the aforementioned Minnelli. The two married in 1945 and worked on two films after this, The Clock, made the year they married, and 1948's The Pirate.
There's never been anything like it in the whole world.
We don't have to come here on a train or stay in a hotel. It's right in our own hometown.
Grandpa, they'll never tear it down, will they?
Well, they'd better not.
I can't believe it. Right here where we live. Right here in St. Louis.
Meet Me in St. Louis was a massive critical and financial success. With its reiteration of family being sacrosanct, the fact that you didn't have to leave your own hometown in order to see something special, which is very similar to The Wizard of Oz's ending, and other elements, it tapped into what a lot of people were feeling during World War II, or dreaming of, especially with so many families separated by the war. It earned a then-insane $5 million at the US box office, and received unanimous praise for Judy Garland and young Margaret O'Brien. It went on to be nominated for 4 Academy Awards for screenplay, cinematography, score, and song for The Trolley Song, with O'Brien receiving a special juvenile award. It turned Arthur Freed's Freed Unit into a big moneymaker at Metro, with musicals dominating the landscape until the mid-1960s. For me, it's a Christmas gem, with the inclusion of Judy Garland's Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas and a charming sequence set during the holidays. When we come back, guest Elwood Jones and I will go more in-depth on Meet Me in St. Louis.
Once again, as in olden days, happy golden days of yore. Faithful friends who were dear to us will be near to us. Until then, we'll have to muddle through somehow. So have yourself a merry little Christmas.
Today I'm talking with the awesome Elwood Jones. Elwood, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing, Kristen?
I'm good. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. So my name is Elwood Jones. I'm a podcaster and blogger and an occasional freelance writer. My main blog is From the Depths of DVD Hell, which has been running really about, I think we're on year 7 now or something. I'm one of the geezers of the blogging world. Podcasting-wise, I run the Mad Bad and Downright Strange Showcase, as well as a TV podcast called TV Good Sleep Bad. And it's really provided this new avenue, really, for talking about cult and obscure cinema or TV, be whatever it is. It's always great to obviously meet new and interesting people and obviously discover new films. That's my whole goal, really, with if I'm podcasting or blogging, is to constantly find new and ever more random movies, it seems.
Well, you know what? You picked a great classic film to talk about today because we are talking about Vincent Minnelli's Meet Me in St. Louis because of Christmas. So was this your first screening of the film?
This was actually my first screening of Meet Me in St. Louis. I was obviously aware of the film because it's one of these established classics, especially being a Judy Garland picture, that you kind of know about Meet Me in St. Louis, even if you've not seen it. And certainly the songs, such as the Ring Ring Goes the Trolley and Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, have sort of evolved outside of the film itself. So a lot of people know the songs without having seen the film. So it was kind of interesting to finally get around to seeing what's obviously considered this classic picture. I think, again, this was a real change-up for certainly my own festive viewing, because normally when Christmas rolls around, I like to look at the alternate Christmas movies, so things such as like Silent Night, Deadly Night, or Christmas Evil, or even more recently Krampus. So it was kind of nice to look at something a little lighter, a little more cheerful than what I would normally be viewing this time of year.
And what did you think of it overall, first time viewing?
I was very surprised. When you go into one of these big musical pictures, and certainly something with a reputation like Meet Me in St. Louis, you've got this feeling that you're going to be drowned in smoltz and it's going to be very giddy and we're going to be bursting into song every 5 minutes. But Meet Me in St. Louis, while it certainly has its standout musical numbers, it's very actually driven by its own drama and the actors' performances. So in one way, I was kind of relieved that it wasn't so much of a heavy musical as I was expecting. And at the same time, I was very happy to see that it's a musical in the classical sense, where the songs are there to drive the film forward rather than we're going to stop so you can have your musical number and then we're going to start again, which has been sort of like the main pitfall of so many more modern musicals when we look at things such as like Sweeney Todd or the more recent and pretty god-awful adaptation of Les Miserables.
This is one of my favorite movies of all time. Favorite Christmas movie, favorite movie just in general. I am a big musical fan, and I didn't actually discover this till I think about 2 years ago. And before this, I'd seen a couple Minnelli films, and I didn't like them. Stuff like Father of the Bride and American in Paris. I don't like An American in Paris. I'm just throwing that out there right now. Please do not send me hate mail. I just don't care for it. But this was where it all came together for me. And Minnelli was one of those directors who worked probably past the point he should have stopped working. And he's got movies, I think, up until the early 80s, I think. And they don't capture the magic that this movie is. And I'm sure somebody will send me an email saying that this isn't a Christmas movie because it's only in the Christmas season for, I think, the final 25 minutes or so of the movie. It's kind of an every holiday film because you get a little bit of winter, you get a little bit of spring, you get fall with Halloween, and then you get Christmas. And I don't know. I think this movie, A, is beautifully shot. It's beautifully acted. It's got some amazing songs, but that final 20 minutes or so is what makes it a Christmas classic for me, and it's got so many great themes. I love this movie. My family knows that when holiday season rolls around, it is not done until Meet Me in St. Louis has played.
I understand how people could obviously say this isn't a Christmas movie because it only has that one little section at Christmas, but the fact that you have on the soundtrack, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, because that song is so synonymous with Christmas, that because we have that musical moment, it instantly becomes a Christmas film. The same way you could obviously argue it's a Halloween film, because it does have that standout Halloween section. Certainly, that for myself was the real standout moment of this film. While we obviously have the wonderful sections during the Christmas period, when we have the Halloween section, I was really shocked at what way it was going. When you have these gangs of like feral kids having mass pyres of burning furniture on the street and going around throwing flour and claiming to kill various members of the neighborhood, it was kind of shocking for what's quite honestly a good-natured musical to see a scene like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that for 1944 I was surprised to see, and I've been fortunate to see this on the big screen at TCM Film Festival. I think 2 years ago we saw it in the Grauman's Chinese Theater, and it was probably one of the best film experiences I've ever had. And I've seen that movie countless times, but seeing it on a big screen, seeing that Technicolor, it was fantastic. You start to notice things that you're a little shocked by. From the opening scene when they're singing Meet Me in St. Louis, which is a beautiful moment where each of the characters gets a chance to sing it, almost like a round. It goes from one person to another, infecting everybody like the flu almost. But when the other sister, Agnes, comes in, she's been swimming in the lake or stream or something. She's soaking wet, and you can see straight through her bloomers. And I was sitting there thinking, is that a small child's backside in this movie? Because it is, I mean, it's essentially just a thin piece of fabric. You can tell that that is a butt. And I was just shocked that in 1944, I know in pre-coat era, you were getting away with a lot more. And here I was just thinking, 1944, we're going to just let the small child's backside hang out. Okay. But then you get the Halloween segment, which that scene is brilliant because the movie is supposed to be about the Smiths. But the Halloween segment is really about Tootie, who is my favorite character, played by Margaret O'Brien. And Elwood, you're totally right. I joked when I reviewed this originally. You remember the idyllic days of yore when apparently small children could take furniture and burn it in a big pile in the street, actually play with matches? These children are about 6 to about 10, and they're lighting stuff on fire. And it's almost like watching, if anybody's seen Dazed and Confused, when they do the hazing scene. And the characters are saying, you know, obviously everybody's cool with this. You know, they're selling concessions. You're waiting for, you know, and the parents in Meet Me in St. Louis are totally fine with this happening. They joke, can the children return the stuff when they steal it? Or they have these bags of flour and they have to go out and they have to throw it in people's face and say, I hate you, because they're going to kill some people. I mean, these are just things that in 2016, you're shocked by it and you're amused by it. Because you would think that in 1944, these kids would not be doing any of this.
No. We have this very sanitized view whenever we look back at these sort of golden periods like the 1940s, 1950s especially, we have this hazy, nostalgic view of what these eras were like. Again, this is the great thing about when you look at classic cinema, is that they act like proper little time capsules of life in that particular period. And as you said, in the Halloween period, it's kind of like Lord of the Flies with these kids. So you've got this, they're burning, I don't know where they've got furniture from, but they're just constantly hurling stuff onto these bonfires. I mean, I've not seen bonfires this big since I left Scouts, where we were pretty much in the mentality of we're going to burn everything in sight.
These are bonfires on residential streets.
I'm very surprised that you named Tootie as your favourite character in this, because obviously she's introduced and everyone else is doing a nice southern accent, and then she turns up and she's like full-blown Cockney accent. It's kind of like the director was there, it's like, okay, you can't do a southern accent, why don't you try something else? This is kind of what she settled on. I was no way that this actress ever did anything other than this picture, and you look it up and obviously Margaret O'Brien went on to become one of these premier child actors. It's always very surprising. Yes, she has got a lot of character to her, but that accent is just awful.
See, I think it's funny that you hear accents, because I don't hear any accents on any of them.
I think it's because, obviously, being in England, you constantly get bombarded. Whenever anyone hears you from England, they instantly go to the Cockney accent, or assume that you live in, like, some Dickensian version of London. So when you have a character like Tootie, kind of triggers more for myself, I guess, because I've sort of tuned my hearing into hearing these.
It's funny, because this movie, to me, is about Esther and Tootie. I always feel bad for Agnes, played by Joan Carroll, because Agnes is the true redheaded stepchild of this movie, because she's not cute like Margaret O'Brien. She doesn't get the chance to flirt with the boys like Esther or her sister, played by Lucille Bremer. You don't have anything for Agnes to do. So I always feel that she's the outlier. And she's got that little stuck-up face. Margaret O'Brien is downright adorable, for starters. She was only, I think, 5 when she made this movie. And she has that precociousness, but it's not annoying. At least I don't find it annoying. She's a morbid little thing. And I think that that was always Margaret O'Brien's strength, to play these characters that probably could be a sociopath in future. If anybody's seen The Unfinished Dance, the delightful story of Margaret O'Brien as a ballerina who accidentally attempts to murder somebody, feels really bad about it for the rest of the film. Here, she's introduced riding the ice truck. Again, the magical days when you could send your 5-year-old to go ride on a wagon with a stranger. And she's telling the ice guy that her dolls are gonna die because she has a fatal disease. She has to go. That's what she keeps saying throughout the movie. And I don't know what it is about Tootie. I think it's her weird morbidity. The fact that during that Halloween scene, which becomes almost like a children's horror film, the way Minnelli tracks her as she goes down the street in this weird little getup with a fake nose, and then goes up to the Brokhov house to throw the flower at him, and she just kind of musters up all her strength, and she says, "I hate you, Mr. Brokhov," and throws it in his face, and then screams and runs away. And she comes back just winded, and everybody thinks that she's been attacked. In the next scene, her and Agnes throw a fake body on the trolley tracks and almost kill everybody. I mean, the original stories were written by Sally Benson about her life in St. Louis in the turn of the century.
The thing with Margaret O'Brien's performance here, she's got the advantage of obviously getting to work with Judy Garland, who in herself is able to adapt her performance. So the fact that these two actresses are constantly paired throughout the film, I think, is one of the real strengths. Whether we're going through the under the bamboo tree dance sequence, or if when we get to the end where she goes absolutely ape in reaction to "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas" and starts destroying all the snowmen, I think those deviant tendencies were there from this film. But when she just goes fully off on one, when as soon as we get to the end of "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas," it's like, "Oh, where's Tootie? Oh, that's right, she's off destroying the snowmen."
Under the Bamboo Tree is probably my favorite song and dance moment. Judy Garland loved young actors because that was her, essentially. So she took Margaret O'Brien under her wing. Later on, she would take Patty Duke under her wing when she almost made Valley of the Dolls. But you can see the way Judy Garland's character, and I don't know if it's improv or if that was scripted, the way she guides Margaret O'Brien during the Bamboo Tree scene, telling her to go over there or mouthing the words so that she knows the song. I mean, all of that just plays very beautifully. And at the end, when she goes out, I'm already crying by the end of this movie, because the way Judy Garland's singing "Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas," the way Margaret O'Brien, who was a consummate crier, she could make
tears look like an art form. But she runs downstairs and she starts decapitating these things. I'm sitting there thinking this is going to be something she does later in life, only it's not going to be a snowman. It's going to be a human.
Oh, but those snowmen are absolutely exquisite, and I thought they have to be like plaster or something. But when she starts hitting them, they actually fall apart like proper snowmen. So what they made them out of, or who sculpted them, I really would love to know that. But they're these exquisite little snow sculptures, and I guarantee no one ever makes snowmen that look as good as these do. But they're like perfect caricatures of like the different family members. As you said already, when she's sort of guiding her through the song and dance movement to Under the Bamboo Tree, it makes sense because of how the scene is set up. That so it covers in many ways for if Garland's obviously guiding O'Brien through the numbers, she's like mouthing the words or she's sort of moving her around. It works within the scene. What's supposed to be like this spontaneous routine that they're putting together to entertain the guests at this party? So it's a really nice relationship they're working to, and Tootie's sister mentioned already before, is kind of pushed to the background and seems to only exist so that we've got a character for Tootie to interact with when there's not another character that we can put her with.
The relationship between Esther and Tootie is this driving force, even though there is a family unit amongst everybody. You have multiple subplots going on in this film that is essentially a series of vignettes. So you have the overarching plot about them moving from St. Louis to New York, which is kind of the central conflict. You have Rose, the older sister played by Lucille Bremer, who is trying to get a guy who is very dense to marry her, or to propose to her at least. Est has this sweet little relationship with the boy next door, John, played by Tom Drake. And that's kind of the entire movie in a nutshell. And I think that that works towards, you see family movies now especially, where family units hate each other, and that's the plot of the film, how they hate each other and they have to come together, usually around a holiday, to tolerate each other, and they learn that they really love each other. This movie is a family that already loves each other, having this thing that changes them, and at the end of the day, still loving each other. I think it's refreshing to see, because we don't get that type of movie today.
No, I think we've focused more on the family dysfunction and the fact that if we have a family that actually like each other, they're seen as being sort of like the freaks. Or normally we have them as full-blown Christians. That's the other way to portray a perfect family. They have to be super religious, very unnerving if they're the perfect family. We kind of prefer our families to be dysfunctional. It's kind of refreshing in a way to see a family that do actually like each other. But certainly when you have the opening there where Rose is waiting on this proposal and the family are trying to stop the father going up to have his bath, and they're trying to make sure the dinner's timed for this phone call. There's some great dialogue, and just the chemistry between the different family members is great, especially with the grandpa character played by Henry Davenport. He was just constantly this mischievous soul throughout the film, and when he takes Esther to the ball at the end, I just love that sequence where they dance around the Christmas tree and it comes out and she's with the guy she was supposed to be going with. There's just something about how this family is constantly there for each other and they're able to help each other for the problems, that it's kind of nice, and it suits this tone of film really, which I guess in many ways could be seen as like an early version of what would be known as like slice of life film, so the 1970s, with things such as like The Last Detail. There's something about this family unit working together that's just, it's nice to see.
That's not to say that the characters come off as perfect. They're not. Esther is kind of a selfish character at times. More than once, she tells Rose that she's not getting any younger. You know, she needs to get married. Or Rose will tell her that men don't want the bloom rubbed off. And Esther says she has too much bloom. That's the problem. Or
I love that line.
My personal favorite always is when John, who is the world's worst boyfriend, I mean, he's kind of dense, tells her that he can't take her to the Christmas dance because his suit is in the shop. And it was his father's suit, so he doesn't have any more suits. And he doesn't know the name of the place that he dropped it off at because he was playing basketball. And Esther tries to tell everybody, you know, oh, that's fine. I don't blame you. I just hate basketball. And that's a great scene because she could take that, the chuck under the chin, and take it with stoic pride, but she doesn't. She tries to be nice about it, but at the same time, she's still telling him she's irritated at him. Or when they do go to the dance, after she says that she refuses to go with her brother because she had a date. She's not going to denigrate herself like her sister who didn't have a date. But they decide to start playing a prank on Lucille Ballard, who is the girl that is supposed to go with Rose's intended, played by a young June Lockhart. And you realize that Lucille's really not that bad. She understands what's going on. And Rose and Esther kind of have to eat some crow and be nice about it. We get these characters that are not grossly flawed for narrative convention, but they got some selfishness. They got a little hostility to them. Not nearly as prominent as Tootie, but they definitely are written authentically.
There's something about Esther's character, the fact that she's very brassy, she's very forthright in what she's going to do. She's not about waiting around for the guys. She obviously openly admits that she's planning on kissing John. You mentioned already that she feels she has too much bloom. With the scene where she's actively trying to seduce John by having him join her turning down the lights, which...
That's a wonder of lighting and cinematography, that moment.
And you kind of wonder, could she lay it on any thicker for John? He's the most oblivious man that I've ever seen. She's basically making the first move for him. He doesn't really have to do anything apart from to respond to her. But apparently his mind's elsewhere. He's afraid of rats or God knows what he thinks going to happen when these lights are getting turned off. But the fact that Esther doesn't care...
And there's that scene where she beats the crap out of him. I don't know any other relationship in a 1940s movie that involves a woman going over to somebody's house to punch them. I think she says at a certain point, I bit him.
I think because we have seen Garland as the Wizard of Oz, so you kind of have this idea of what sort of character she's going to play. And then we see her in this role, and she doesn't care about how she's perceived by society and whole. She's not there to play the damsel waiting to be rescued. Knows what she wants, and she knows in her own mind how she plans on getting it. I love the scene where her sister actually scolds her for having this idea of wanting to kiss John. Because, you know, men don't want to marry a girl who's obviously been out kissing boys before she's married. She's a very modern woman for myself.
She's mired in the turn of the century conventions. But at the same time, you're right. She does have this brassiness. She's a forward thinker. She's very devoted to her family, which I kind of roll my eyes in certain movies where the female has to decide between her family unit and the guy she's dating. Neither the two shall meet. But Minnelli, the screenwriters, really make it that Esther can have it all. She can have the boy next door, and she can have her love for her family. When her and Rose are singing a song in the beginning of the movie, they're framed with a statue of two sisters in close proximity that kind of mimics their union. I definitely think she's got some early feminist moments. It's not fantastic, but the script doesn't really require it to be, which is a benefit. We should touch on where Judy Garland was at her career at this point. By 1944, she had just exploded post Wizard of Oz and was making movies left and right, predominantly with her co-star Mickey Rooney, and she had just made three movies before that. This was her only movie of 1944. She took a bit of a break and came back and made two other movies after this. She made The Clock right after this, which was also with Vincent Minnelli, and both her and Minnelli have said that Meet Me in St. Louis is where they fell in love. They ended up getting married and had a daughter, Liza. Judy Garland always said that she never looked good in movies and that she was always filmed very poorly, and that Vincent Minnelli, the way he filmed her, made her look beautiful. So if you watch that Boy Next Door song, it's very gauzy, very bright lighting. She's got good makeup on. She's got good hair. I mean, he films her in a way that makes her look beautiful, especially at the end in that red dress. If you are a Judy Garland fan like I am, you'll know that the thinner the waist, the more medicated she was. She's really active in this movie, which means she was popping a lot of pills to keep that way. But at the same time, I mean, she's a consummate professional. She's amazing in this movie. She goes through a litany of emotions. She's angry. She's happy. She's frightened. She's sad. I mean, she goes through it all, and she's filmed beautifully. I always say, if you want to watch Judy Garland at her peak in terms of musical prowess, I always say this in The Harvey Girls from 46. Judy Garland with a pair of guns in The Harvey Girls is both dangerous and amazing at the same time. This was the film that, even though she's playing, I think, 18 or something, that pushed her into moving away from Dorothy Gale, moving away from being a child and into a serious adult actress.
I mean, you mentioned there Mickey Rooney, and I was actually kind of relieved when you brought him up that he wasn't in this film. Because ever since I saw Breakfast at Tiffany's, I vowed that I would never watch anything with Mickey Rooney because I was so offended by his yellow face performance.
I actually watched a couple of them this year for the first time, Babes in Arms and Girl Crazy and Strike Up the Band, and they're cute movies. But I have an issue with the fact that Mickey Rooney's character is the one taking the lead, and that the intent of Judy Garland's character is supposed to be the sad, lovelorn girl who is constantly told she's not good enough for Mickey Rooney. And I said, wait, what? This is Mickey Rooney. This isn't Cary Grant. So I don't understand how he can tell her, look, you're kind of fat and you're kind of ugly. Well, Mickey, you ain't a catch yourself.
Mickey Rooney, because he was around so long, he got into his mind that he was some sort of voice of authority within the Hollywood system.
Let's talk about the musical as a whole and how this film utilizes it. Because there's two schools of thought with musicals. There's the ones that appreciate the people who spontaneously burst into song, and that is the film soundtrack. Or there's the people that say the music should be part of the plot line. So you have the West Side Story model, where characters just spontaneously jump into song, or you have Inside Llewyn Davis, where the character being a musician is the reason why there is song. And I've heard people who say that one is more of a quote-unquote musical than the other. We have kind of an old-school throwback musical coming out in the next couple of weeks, La La Land. For me, I will take a musical in any way, shape, or form. But I always tend to say that a musical, as I know it, is like Meet Me in St. Louis. Meet Me in St. Louis, though, does a great example of blending both of those schools. Because you have characters who will randomly burst into song, Esther singing The Boy Next Door to nobody but the audience. But there's also moments where there's a reason for them to sing. You know, Under the Bamboo Tree is them entertaining guests at a party. Or Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas is her trying to console Tootie with the world's saddest Christmas song of all time. Actually, I think the lyrics of that song were changed because there's a line in the original song that was something, next year we could all be dead. Or it was implying that essentially Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas because you could die tomorrow. And Judy Garland objected to that. She said, I can't sing that to Margaret O'Brien. So I think Meet Me in St. Louis is a great example of both thoughts of the musical genre, both aspects coming together and presenting the kind of the ultimate movie musical.
This is a musical where the song's driving it forward. This is a problem with a lot of modern musicals in the fact that they want to focus on the technical ability of the performance. They have these songs with the ridiculously high note, or they don't seem to be telling a story, or it's serving a purpose to drive the story forward. It's just, oh, we're going to stop, so we're going to have this musical moment, and I can show how good my technical ability is. And I'm thinking, well, that's all great if I'm like a theatre student and stuff, but for someone in the audience who's trying to follow the story and you're just stopping to go off on a musical whim, it's not giving me anything. The same way that with Meet Me in St. Louis, the range of songs that we have are sort of carry this film through. We have this good mixture of nice little ballads like Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. We have like show-stopping moments such as like the trolley song, and it has that wonderful mixture between the two. It's not, again, which I find with a lot of musical numbers, where you just have the numbers essentially sounding the same, and it gets you after a while. So I appreciate what it does with the songs.
There is a great, you brought up the term soundtrack legacy here with this movie, because the songs are just so ubiquitous with popular culture, at least. Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas had been recorded previously, but don't quote me on that, I could be incorrect. But it's become this big Christmas classic, and I think a lot of people forget that Judy Garland's version is the one that a lot of people discovered for the first time back in 1944, and everybody's covered it since. The version that gets the most play is the Frank Sinatra version, and the Judy one is the best interpretation because it is the most melancholy. Because it's not a happy song. I mean, this isn't Jingle Bells. In the context of the movie, it's being sung to Tootie as a means of consolation. Because they are going to move. They're going to leave St. Louis. They have to give up all their friends and loved ones and the cat and Marjorie Main's maid.
Oh, what a shame to give her up.
And the song is there to tell her, as long as we're all together, it doesn't matter how life changes. But at the same time, it's a very sad song, because it's going to tell you things are going to change. You can't keep things the way they are, so live in the moment, essentially. And the way Judy sings it so plaintively works. Whereas when Sinatra sings it, it's Sinatra. It's a somber song, but it's not going to make you cry.
Oh, definitely. With Sinatra, I mean, he made further changes to your song because, as you said already, he felt it was too downbeat. It was more little surge changes, such as they changed Next Year to From Now On. And when we look at the original words to it, I mean, you mentioned already the fact that it's got this undertone of death to it. There's the line in the original line, next year we all be living in the past, have yourself a Merry Christmas, and pop that champagne cork, next year we may be living in New York. And
the song works the best here. It never fails to turn me into a sobbing mess. Again, I went and saw this at Grauman's Chinese Theater, and I was surrounded by people, and I turned into just a dribbling mess of emotions, because that song is just so amazing. And the way Margaret O'Brien's looking out the window, she starts screaming and starts decapitating snowmen. And you have to love poor Leon Ames, who plays the father of the group, Alonzo, is perpetually three steps behind his family, starting from the opening scene when he doesn't understand why everybody wants to eat so quickly. But you watch the movie and he sees his child decapitating snowmen. He's just, that looks bad. I should go out there. And he decides to sit down and smoke his pipe. And the light bulb moment literally personifies itself as him burning his hand, his fingers, with the match. That makes him decide that he doesn't want to move his family. Slow on the uptake there, guy. And it culminates with probably my favorite scene. There's a moment where Rose has been going back and forth with this guy, who, again, is not the brightest bulb in the shed. And he shows up finally at the end of the movie, just walks into their house and points at her and says, Rose Smith, this can't go on any longer. And he walks out and he comes back and he says, I love you. And he just leaves. And Alonzo says, I don't know that boy, but I feel I should get to know him or something to that effect. And I think that those little moments of levity, especially at his character's expense, work really well.
Very surprised at how downplayed the romantic element of this film was. My only reference point going into this film was the fact it was brought up in Sex and the City.
I did not know that.
Carrie's assistant, she's from St. Louis, and they're banging on about watching Meet Me in St. Louis. So she's using it as this reference point into her relationship with Mr. Big. I thought, this is going to be like a romantic film. It's going to be about Esther and how her and John just can't get it together, and by the end, get it together. But no, John shows up at the start, and then he disappears off, and we go through Halloween, and we're pretty much almost done with Christmas, and then, oh, John's back again. When he comes back, he's then proposing marriage, and it's sort of like, that kind of got tacked on at the end there. So I was expecting the romance element to be much more prominent than it was, especially being a classic, they come with this element of romance to them. This felt very much to me the same way that a film like The Last Detail would. It's this slice of life moment. You just happen to be with this family for longer than a few days. You're with them over the course of several seasons.
There's a lot of similarities between this and Little Women. They remade Little Women a couple years after this with Elizabeth Taylor and Janet Leigh and Margaret O'Brien. Margaret O'Brien actually plays Beth, which if y'all know what happens to Beth at the end of Little Women, that'll make you cry too. I think you're right on that this is not necessarily a plot-driven movie. It's, again, broken up into vignettes. What's important is their family unit.
I didn't mind the fact that we just have this series of moments with this family, because these characters are so likable and so enjoyable to be around. And even the maid and the grandpa, these supporting characters, seem to have more relevance to them than you would expect them to have. Katie the maid, I don't know how she's still employed. Did she come with a house or something?
She's Marjorie May, and I think she just walked in and started working and said, fire me, I dare ya.
Because at the start, you got the young daughters and they're asking with the cat, and it's, oh yeah, I kicked her down the cellar, I heard her neck crack.
This movie has a really morbid undertone to it. We got cat kicking and dolls being buried in the backyard and bodies being thrown onto trolley track. It's amazing.
I was so surprised at the directions this film constantly took. I mean, obviously, the Merry Little Christmas moment, I phased out a bit, and I think it's because it's been so overplayed as a Christmas carol. There was very little that scene could give to me, and maybe I'm just cold and callous, so I kind of drifted away on that moment. And it kind of brought me back in when we cut to 2D and she's off decapitating snowmen. That was a nice, unexpected moment. It constantly surprised me with what was happening.
And I think it's worth pointing out that World War II had not ended. It wouldn't officially end for another year. And so this is playing into the World War II contingent of people who were growing up or didn't have access to their loved ones during this time or had loved ones who had died. So it plays as this somber tribute to the fallen people who had given their life in World War II. And it's something Judy Garland would revisit the next year with The Clock, which is about GI coming home from the war. But it's almost at odds with a lot of the other movies that were coming out in the late wake of the war and after the war had ended. I bring up Little Women, which again is another turn of the century movie, but it doesn't have that morbidity if this one does, or Miracle on 34th Street, which came out about 3 years later, which just totally ignores the war element and says, we should all be optimistic. The Smith family, they're not hurting. And that's what I find intriguing, because the screwball comedy ended when the Depression started, because nobody wanted to see the lives of these wealthy people and, oh, look at how daffy they are. Nobody had anything. Whereas by World War II time, you still had rationing and struggle. But this movie really says, hey, go back to a simpler time before we had war, before we had the Depression. And you can appreciate that these characters live in a big house. Alonzo constantly brings up how they spend money and he needs to do whatever he has to do at work because they could be in the poorhouse one day, and they're talking about moving to New York and living in a tenement, which I think is at odds with the way they're living now, because why would Alonzo want to downgrade? And at the same time, if he's getting enough money to move to New York and the company wants him to go there, wouldn't they then be living in the same financial spectrum that they were living in now?
If I saw Alonzo, I just assumed he was going to be some screwball news editor. I didn't think he would be in the banking sector. And the way he talks and stuff is, and I love the line at the end where it's sort of, oh, New York doesn't have the monopoly on good luck. Constantly complaining about how they cut the corned beef. How he can go this whole movie when all these things are happening around him and be so caught up in his own little bubble. No one in his family, and I think they, right from the start, no one wants to move away from St. Louis. Yet, he's got into his mind that everyone's on board with this great plan he has.
Well, he doesn't really give the plan a lot of thought, because again, they have not just the maid, they also have the grandfather. So you're going to need a room for him and his wife, Esther and Rose, until she gets married. You better marry her off quick or send her to college, which is going to cost money. How are you going to send her to college if you're moving to New York? Tootie and Agnes, that's six people, seven if you count Grandpa. So where are you going to live that's not a house in New York for all these people to live in?
I don't know. Maybe they're going to be like the buckets in Charlie and Chocolate Factory. Just all have one big bed.
We'll have four living, sleeping in one bed, and just hope you marry him off quickly.
Kate and the maid, she can stay in St. Louis. I mean, that's not a big loss.
Fired. She's done.
Tootie would probably be off in a Young Offenders Institute if she carries on the way she's going.
If she kills Grandpa and then we send her off, two birds, one stone.
Did you notice at the end when they're all packed up to move, and you look on the wall and you can see the dirt marks where the picture frames have been? And it's like, what was Kate and the maid actually doing? Because cleaning clearly wasn't what it was doing. I didn't realize how grotty the house was until they started taking the pictures off.
Apparently she was too busy making ketchup and kicking cats.
Yes. Oh my god, the whole scene was about making ketchup. I've never seen so much conversation about making ketchup before.
I did not know that people made ketchup, and I think somebody told me that the ketchup back in that time period was more like pasta sauce. It wasn't like ketchup like we know today.
It was more fruity in its concoction, and certainly thicker in its consistency. As we certainly see in the film, it's kind of looks in many ways like what you would dip caramel apples into. It's that sort of same consistency.
It looks like V8 almost. Let's wrap this up. Final thoughts. I love this movie. I love this movie so much. I will watch this anytime it is presented to me. It's a beautifully shot film. I love Margaret O'Brien. I love Judy Garland. The script works for me, even though some of the plot machinations seem a bit tacked on. And John Truitt is the worst boyfriend ever. But that's about it. So I think this is almost the quintessential family movie. I think a lot of other movies in its wake tried to play on similar sentiments. Again, I bring up Little Women. Even Miracle on 34th Street, I think, has similarities here in terms of that emphasis on family overall and this return to simpler times, although Miracle on 34th Street might get the edge in terms of better writing, but again, it's only the edge. Maybe next year we'll talk about that film. But overall, I really enjoy this movie, so it never gets old for me. Elwood, what are your overall thoughts on Meet Me in St. Louis?
As a first-timer, I was greatly surprised by how good this film was. I don't think I've been surprised by a classic piece of cinema since the first time I watched Calamity Jane, and I think it also had a lot to do with the timing of when I was watching this. Even though it's a classic piece of cinema, it's not, and it's certainly a musical, it's not overwhelming in either of these contexts. So even if you're not familiar with classic cinema, someone like myself, a complete Luddite, can still enjoy this film for what it is. It's just such a charming little film. And at the same time, it's got these darker moments to it, and these wonderfully comedic moments. You only have to look at the end scene with the ball, and you've got the different dance partners that they have, and these guys certainly have some interesting approaches to dancing, should we say. It made me wonder why girls are wasting their time with them. I think this is one to add into that rare power of musicals I actually enjoy.
Well, let me know what you think about Meet Me in St. Louis or some other Christmas films that you enjoy. You can email your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. Once again, I'd like to thank Elwood Jones for joining me today. Once again, Elwood, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Well, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm @Elwood_Jones. The blog is always the best place to find whatever film I'm rambling about that week. That is From the Depths of DVD Hell.blogspot.co.uk. As I said, I've got the podcast out there. We've got the MBDS Showcase and TV Good Sleep Bad. Both of those are on iTunes and Podomatic. Please come let us know what you think. Hopefully I can switch you on some weird and wonderful films.
During the recording of this episode, it was announced that Joan Carroll, who played Agnes in Meet Me in St. Louis, passed away at the age of 85. So this episode is dedicated in her memory. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio, or on iTunes. If you listen via iTunes, please consider leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, @gmail.com, or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. The podcast is also now on Twitter at ticklish_biz, so if you want to know what's going on with the podcast, definitely follow there. And if you enjoy my work on the show or my website, please consider supporting me on Patreon. Patrons who donate can get access to early episodes, pick the movies or themes I discuss, even guest on a future episode. If you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Apologies for having the wrong link in the last episode. Next time, another special guest and I will bid farewell to 2016 by looking at some of the classic films we've discovered for the first time this year. Feel free to send in your own classic film discoveries via Twitter or email, and I'll read them on the next episode. Before we close out, I'd like to wish everyone a safe and happy holiday. Till next time, have yourself a Merry Little Christmas.